It's another Books of the Year podcast from your friends at Books of the Year, a podcast. It's an occasional podcast. Apologies for the break in service. This is down to... being let down.
Let down by transport.
Other things.
Other things, Matt
and
yes.
Matt and I were here waiting for this thing to happen, and this thing didn't happen.
Didn't happen, did it? No.
Sadly, we know whose fault it was, but there you go.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're back now, firing on all cylinders. Here's an email from Gareth Harris. Simon and Matt, I appreciate the review and discussion on A Terrible Kindness. This is quite a while back. However, I recently read it and would like to thank you for the recommendation. It's a wonderful piece of storytelling that left me incredibly moved and longing for home. I'm now based in Manchester, but grew up in Swansea and still call it home. Growing up in South Wales, Aberfan features strongly in any child's upbringing. The description of the events at Pantglass in the opening 50 pages will stay with me for a long time. The perspectives of many people at that time have been heard, the role of the embalmers less so. The rawness of Joe Browning-Rowe's account of William's time in Aberfan moved me like no other book. I've never written to a podcast before, but this wonderful book has prompted me to thank both of you for the recommendation. P.S. Also based on your discussion, says Gareth in Manchester. I've just finished Rob Drummond's Your Old Talk, Informative and Enjoyable, and S.A. Cosby's All the Sinners Bleed, His Best Yet.
Correct, yeah.
Thank you.
It's odd, isn't it? When people sort of mention books that we did a while back, so Terrible Kindness obviously is a long time. I remember... We did that interview. I remember I was in my bedroom trying to get a better signal. I literally sitting right next to my Wi-Fi router trying to get a better signal when we were doing that. This from Hilary Hansel on Twitter. Thanks for the really insightful chat with Tom Burgess. A fascinating interview. P.S. Simon, I never knew you'd stolen a goat.
I haven't stolen a goat.
You did not steal a goat. But
when did I steal a goat?
Who knows? Thanks also for letting us know what you've been reading recently. Claire Collins is enjoying Bridges of Clay by Marcus Susak. Why, that is a long time ago we had Marcus on. Mick Brown currently reading and loving 7 Days by Robert Rutherford. And James Carter has just finished William Boyd's Any Human Heart.
Which is also going back some way. If you'd like to tell us what you're reading, good or bad, recommendations, that kind of thing, what you make of the authors that you hear and those who don't. our email is booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. You can stop us in the street. We'll tell you what we're talking about. booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. You can tweet us at Books of the Year on Instagram and Threads. Pick any page. I am on Blue Sky.
Yes, you are indeed on Blue Sky.
The coolest.
Yeah, all the people are going to Blue Sky now, aren't they?
Right, time with our special guest now, best-selling, fabulous author, David Nicholls. So the new book from David Nicholls is called You Are Here, and fortunately he is.
He is here, isn't he?
Unlike some authors here. Who aren't. Hello, David, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
It's very, very nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Was You Are Here always going to be the title?
No, it was called Walking and Talking till quite late, which is fine, but I'm never very good at titles. They always get changed. One day was called St. Swithin's Day all the way through. Start of a term was called Knowledge. So there's always a discussion. A title is a strange thing. It's almost not part of the writing. It's almost part of the marketing. And I had a A4 page of different titles, and You Are Here seemed to be the best.
Well, have we got special copies, the ones with the cutout?
The cutout. The first 20,000 have the cutout, and then it got too expensive to do them all.
Right. So Matt, describe the cover that you got here.
So it's a great cover. It is leaping out, this one. So it's mainly all in blue. Blue and yellow are the colours that are going to grab your attention. And the sort of outer surface of the book is like those relief maps that you get on OS maps. And it's in blue and darker blue. David Nicholls in big, bold yellow letters at the top and a little a golden bench at the bottom as well, and some great stuff here. The new novel by the number one best-selling author of One Day, Catherine Rundell, says, gorgeously witty and joyful. Caitlin Moran, Nicholls' best book ever. Magnificent, says Marianne Keyes. Nigella Lawson, such a lovely book. The Observer, no one does the minutiae of love as well as Nicholls. But as you've already hinted at, there is a cutout of one of those sort of location markers that we have on our phones, like an upside-down teardrop, that is cut out of the front cover, which when you pull it out reveals you are here. Yes. Against an OS map from the Lake District, I think.
It's very expensive and complicated to do, I'm told. So I'm very flattered that they put the effort in, but not forever. After a while, it's just gone to a more conventional
single but cover. An expensive cover means confidence in this
writer. Yes, it does, doesn't it?
I know, I'm very flattered. It means grateful.
Confidence, definitely, all the way through. It shouts confidence. That's what it says. And the fact that Caitlin Moran says it's your best book ever. When you were writing this, did you think, this is going quite well? Or do you get to the end and go, I'm not quite sure? I mean, are you a good judge of your own work?
I found the writing really enjoyable, and I handed it in, and then it went very quiet for a while, and I got a little bit anxious about it. And the first draft, I think, was really good, but then I got my notes and I went back to it, and I spent a long time on the second draft, about 9 months, and the structure of the story didn't really change. The characters were just tweaked a little bit, but I wrote it out again. I physically typed it out again, and it's definitely the best written book, I think, in that sentence by sentence it's the book where I've taken the most care. And I guess that doesn't always necessarily equate to most popular or most emotionally involving, but for me, this is the book which is closest to my ambitions when I set out to write it.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm particularly intrigued, only because I'm waiting to hear back from my editor. That David Nichols sent in a book, and then it all went quiet. What the hell was going on there?
Well,
there better be a very good excuse.
I think, again, it's a good thing. I think a lot of people were reading it and they were making sure, you know, the last thing you want as a novelist is contradictory notes. So the notes were being compiled from a number of people, and they were very, very, very good notes. So I was very grateful to have them. And I took them all on. And the book got much, much better. I think often novelists, you know, there's this image of the novelist working alone, whereas the scriptwriter is collaborating with all these different voices. And for me, the truth is somewhere in the middle with a novel. I do listen to notes and I do act on them, and almost always they do make the book better. So I'm very grateful for that editorial input as well.
I remember having this conversation with Lee Child, I don't remember if you remember, a couple of years ago, and he just said, I don't get many notes.
No, I know. A lot of writers.
I'd be scared. Would you give Lee Child notes?
No, I'm I'm not a pushover, but I do like to hear what people think. And I know there are other novelists who you know, there's no second draft. They just hand it in. That's it. Muriel Spark never did a second draft. Anita Bruckner just handed it in. That's what they published. And that's amazing. But for me, I'm curious as to how people react to the characters and the story, and I want to make sure that it matches with my intentions.
Okay, well, introduce us to the characters. Actually, this kind of preamble is relevant to one of them. But anyway, just tell us where we are and who are the characters that we're following here.
So the two main characters are Marnie, who's a copy editor who lives alone in London, self-employed, divorced since her 20s, hasn't had a relationship since. She's 37 years old when we meet her. Very much a Londoner, very much an indoors person. Not lonely, but living a solitary life. She's become slightly antisocial, maybe, since the pandemic, but is content enough. And Michael is a geography teacher from York, very passionate about the outdoors, a keen walker. Unfortunately, his marriage has just collapsed during lockdown, as many did. And so he's suddenly facing up to life alone. And his response to that is to hit the hills, is to get outside, get away from the family home and spend a great deal of time by himself. And they're brought together by a mutual friend, Cleo, who's a head teacher at Michael's school, for a weekend's walking holiday in the lakes with some other people. And over the course of that 3-day walking holiday, the other characters fall away until it's just Marnie and Michael. Michael is setting out to walk all the way across the country on the famous coast-to-coast path, and Marnie joins him, initially against Michael's will, but over the next few days, a kind of a bond forms between them, and it's a sort of slow-motion love story that takes place on the 10 days of this long journey.
Why a copy editor and why a geography teacher?
Well,
were they always those?
The copy editing thing came to me quite early. I think Marnie is, I wanted someone who was self-employed and who works alone and who loves books. And Marnie is brilliant with language. She's very precise. She's very observant. She knows exactly what's going on when people are talking. She has a kind of running commentary to all the conversations she takes part in. And that seemed to me a good match, you know, because a copy editor is employed to pay incredible attention to every word. And there's also some comedy, I guess, in the gap between the books she reads and edits and the reality of the life she's living. That seemed to me a potentially funny, ironic contrast. So it was also a job that I'm very grateful to my copy editors. It's different from editing a book. It's less editorial in that you're not giving creative notes, but you are paying very, very, very close attention to the prose. And I always feel when my book has been copy edited that it's been dry cleaned. It's been made crisp and clear.
So it would be stuff like, you said he was left-handed in the first chapter, but he appears to be right-handed now. It's that kind of pedantry.
Yeah, if the story lasts a year and you say the character's 37 at the beginning, they have to be 38 at the end. You have to know when the birthday is. You have to know the words that the author tends to use too often. You have to spot the factual errors. You obviously correct the punctuation and the spelling, but you also, you have an eye on the style, whether it's repetitious, whether the paragraphing is correct, all of those things. That just seemed a very good match for Marnie's sensibility, which is extremely intelligent, but perhaps not confident enough to be an editor. She doesn't work in publishing. She's very much self-employed, solitary, and that seemed to fit the character.
And the geography teacher?
Well, I love the outdoors. And when I was a kid, geography was always a sort of slightly sneered at for being a slightly boring subject. But my son studies geography and he's really, really passionate about the subject. And so listening to him talk about it and realizing what the subject can be, it seemed to fit Michael. You know, Michael is really a very good teacher, a passionate teacher, who absolutely is much, much happier outdoors. But there's a kind of melancholy to him as well. There's a kind of a sadness that he carries with him. And he's a little, particularly at this stage of his life, a little more comfortable by himself, happier by himself, wary of human contact, human relationships. And so that seemed to, again, be a good fit. I like the idea of this man roaming the moors and fells by himself as a form of escape. So that kind of, I think the model I had in my head for him was sort of Gabriel Oak, a novel I really love. And I quite like the romance of that. And I'm not sure if Gabriel Oak now would be a geography teacher, but it seemed to be as close as I could find. And again, it seemed to offer up potential for humour, this country-city tension that runs through the novel.
Also, that's sort of the idea, the geography teacher is much maligned. In other words, geography. If you said geography teacher, I'm sure everyone listening to this will straight away have an image come into their mind, and it's not always a great one.
No,
I want to talk a little bit more about the act of them walking, and I'm going to go to something that's really quite far into the book. There's no spoilers here, but Marnie's talking to someone. She talks about walking, the act of these two walking. There's something about walking, she says, things slip out. It's like taking a truth serum or something. Also, it was very beautiful. And it's absolutely right. When if it's just two people walking, I feel that you'll be more honest than even if the two of you were sat opposite each other, as we are now in this sort of banquette, you'd be far more honest if you were just walking and walking for a distance and time. Just talk a little bit more about, you know, why you chose it to be that kind of environment that you're going to bring these two characters in.
Yeah, I mean, it's for a start, there's all this time to fill. You know, if you're walking 10 hours a day, you're going to, it's way beyond a date. You're going into a different mode of conversation. And the lack of eye contact, I think, is important as well. And perhaps there's something about the rhythm of the step. And I think there's a very definite flavor to the conversations. I usually walk by myself, but when I am with friends, there's a definitely a distinctive flavor to the conversations you have. It's not quite therapy, but you do find yourself saying things you wouldn't normally say sitting opposite each other in a cafe. So I wanted it to be It's very much a conversation piece. Walking and Talking was a perfectly good title because the two in my mind are related. And I did want to write a novel about that slow unveiling of character. That gradually they start with banter, and then there's some irritation and some arguing. And then there's a kind of conversation that seems trivial, but maybe is more revealing. And then finally they open up to each other. And that seemed to me to be an interesting thing to explore. And if you're walking next to someone for 8 hours, things are going to slip out.
It's a different genre, obviously. And I've mentioned Lee Child, and also Ian Rankin talks about sort of having an initial idea, starting and then seeing where the story takes them.
Yeah.
Did you know Marnie and Michael's story completely at the beginning? When they start out on the walk, do you know everything about them, or did some of their character emerge as you were walking and talking with them?
I know everything. Yeah, I'm a big planner. I know I did the walk myself, and obviously that experience fed into the book. So when it rains in the book, it rained in the research trip as well. Some of the misery of it found its way into the pages. So I was kind of shaped a little bit by experience. The story was influenced by what I went through doing the research. But I do know the arc, yeah. And I do think very much in terms of scenes, set pieces, acts. You know, I'm full of admiration for writers who can improvise, but I like to know the destination as I do when I go walking, to carry on the metaphor. And that doesn't mean it doesn't change. So this novel, there are four or five different endings. I had what I thought was a perfectly good ending, but it didn't quite convince. And so my editor, Fede, made me go back and do it again and then again and then again until we got something which was satisfying without being glib. So things do change along the way, and of course there's invention along the way. But for me, I'm always frightened of abandoning it halfway through because I don't know where it's going. So I do have a story which I feel will probably work before I start on chapter one.
The thing we've not said about the book yet is that it's very, very funny. It's really funny. Absolutely hilarious. And you know that a book is connecting. Well, here's my theory on when a book is connecting, is when people who you don't normally associate with books are telling you about how great this book is.
Great.
And I read, and this is going to sound bizarre, but there is a column I read written by an estate agent who was talking about your book, great, about how much he loves your book. And so, there were loads of laugh out loud bits. Here's one of my favourites is, and we don't need to give any spoilers here, obviously, but we know one of the characters is a wrong'un, because when you walk into his house, he's got a poster of Moonraker, the Bond movie, there. And you're like, and another character turns to the other and says, "You need to leave now, because he's gonna..." And I thought, how did you get to Moonraker? Was it just, it's going to be one of the Bond movies, but it's not going to be one of the great Bond movies? How did you get to Moonraker?
I think it's the pigeon doing the double take in St. Mark's Square that's where it all goes wrong with me for Bond. I mean, those references, you have to sort of think yourself into Marnie's point of view. I actually quite like Moonraker, but I know who Marnie is. And I know that there are certain things that are going to, that are not her taste, not her approach to the world. And Moonraker seemed to be very high on that list. So, yes, she makes a mistake with the man she marries, and it doesn't work out. And she also is very funny about that. I mean, that's the joy of writing a funny character, is you have this opportunity to go back and revise and polish and add the jokes. You know, often in life you leave a party and you go home and you think, oh, I really should have said this. Yeah. It would have brought the house down. And when you write a novel, you have 2 or 3 years to put those jokes
in. She says her husband was like the least attractive one in the boy band.
Yes.
Which I thought was fantastic, because it was such a perfect illustration, because everyone knows that you go, yeah, good looking, oh, shame about the guy. And that's who she married.
She's I think Marnie is sort of this comes up a lot, a bit like Emma in One Day. She lacks confidence. She's clearly brilliant mind, intelligent, a lovely, funny, generous person, who doesn't necessarily have the confidence that she ought to have in herself, and makes this terrible choice and sort of lives with it for a long time. And when it doesn't work out, I mean, she makes jokes about it, but I think reading between the lines of the novel, you can tell that it really is quite it's a terrible relationship, and it's good that she's out of it, but it has put her off the whole idea of romantic love. And the novel is about her sensing the possibility that there might be another chance.
On the list of things I wanted to talk to you about, I wrote down fresh socks, orgy, adjectives. Words that have never gone together. I think the orgy is probably best left to people to enjoy once they get to in the book. But on the adjectives thing, I thought this was fantastic. So we're back talking about Marnie. With adjectives, so this is you, obviously. Mm. I'm reading from your book, which always feels a little bit clumsy. The conventional, so this is in a sentence, right? Mm. It's quite startling. With adjectives, the conventional order is opinion, size, age, shape, colour. You don't learn that. You just know it's the lovely little old round red robin. But she's gone size, colour, size, and it's not even the right colour. So she's talking, I think this is the person who wrote the orgy.
Yeah, she's editing the orgy again.
And it has never occurred to me that of course, is the orgy, the order, that it's opinion, overweight, small, size, age, shape, colour.
Yeah.
Is that, like, taught? If I'd gone to school properly, would that have...
I don't think so, no. I had to look it up, and it rang true. And, yeah, there is an order to adjectives that everyone just knows. Isn't that strange? Yeah. I mean, I think Imani is full of that kind of detailed knowledge that, you know, Baron's Court doesn't have an apostrophe and Earl's Court does. And you that kind of thing that you need to know in her job.
Because they're both annoying, and aren't they? Because geography teachers can be annoying when they're pointing out everything as you go for a walk. My father was a geography teacher.
Right.
So, you know, but of course that's what you do, because you know what that thing over there is called, and I don't know what that thing over there is called. So she's a pedant, she's a geography teacher. That's going to be funny, isn't it?
Yeah. He's very excited about the landscape, and she can't quite see it. You know, views are lovely, but you don't need to stand all that time. You can move on. And I love that friction between them. You know, it's very much very much part of that kind of odd couple tradition that I really love. If you wrote a novel about two people who really enjoy walking and they go on a walk, there's no story there. You need to have the friction for there to be narrative.
I think you have a real talent, David, for being able to show intimacy between two people without actually doing the whole sort of, and then they got together and lots of sex, that kind of thing. The orgies are a different part of that. But here's the sequence that shouted out intimacy to me was when they put the iPhone on shuffle and they listened to, because basically I remember doing that. I remember doing that with two people I was working with, guy is about my age and a woman who's about 20 years younger than us, and we were driving across Germany, and I basically said to him, why don't we just put your iPhone on shuffle? And he was so nervous, and he was saying, well, I should tell you that my daughter also has access to my Spotify account. And so I just talk to me about how that you coming to the idea that that's how I'm going to describe this intimacy is, let's just listen to my phone and whatever comes up.
It seemed to me to be a really good metaphor for how we are when we meet someone. You know, when you meet someone, you're trying to be your best self. And quite early, I find in friendships, you talk about music, you talk about the films you love, the books you love. And it's always the choices you make are a reflection of you. So, of course, you put thought into it and care. I like the idea that they have access to everything, you know, that the embarrassing tracks, the music that's there because of a teenage memory, but which they can barely bear to listen to. I like the idea of a kind of unedited representation of their characters. And so that seemed a fun idea. They have this rule. Marnie says, you know, we're not allowed to skip. We're just going to shuffle everything. It's not a playlist. It's the whole library. It seemed to me a nice metaphor of getting to know someone, because you're getting to know, you know, the less attractive stuff, the less cool stuff, the darker stuff, the stuff that's a little bit embarrassing. Mm. So I loved writing that. I mean, I in my notebooks, there are pages and pages and pages of Marnie and Michael talking about, you know, B-sides and obscure album tracks and classical music and soundtracks. And you can pick almost any song and riff off it. So those chapters could have gone on much, much longer. But yeah, my German my German publisher said, we'd love to put this playlist online. And I had to say, really, don't do it. You know, that's not the point of it. It isn't. I've, with my previous novels, with One Day Sweet Sorrow, there are playlists on my Spotify account. But with this book, I wanted it to be not always brilliant music. There are a couple of good songs in there, but it's not all great.
Well, that's the key, isn't it? That's the gold is in the tracks that are a little bit embarrassing. Don't know how that slipped through.
They're too unlimited that sends Marnie into a frenzy. Yeah.
I used to play that a lot. Although it is a terrible record. Can you just... I've had this thought, which many people have had, that COVID is going to affect storytelling for the rest of our lives, because a bit like the way we're still finding stories to tell about the First and Second World War.
Yeah.
Everybody has a COVID story. It's impacted on everybody listening to this podcast, and COVID has impacted on Marnie and Michael.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit what your thinking was and what difference it's... You've hinted at it, but just explain a little bit more about how that's affected them and their relationships.
When I sat down to write this book, I mean, COVID was just coming to an end. And I was, my last book was set in 97. And I thought, well, you've got to write something set now. And the now seemed so strange, so untypical. I didn't want to wait. You know, I wanted to get on with writing. And so I started thinking about this book at that point where we were coming out of it and we were seeing our friends again and we were stepping out into the world. And I suppose my two observations were that the first is that it became very nerve-wracking to see friends. It became, for me, I was very self-conscious, didn't know what to say, really didn't have anything to talk about except this big thing, this pandemic, and was aware that other friends of mine who lived alone had had an entirely different experience, an experience that for a lot of them was quite challenging and again, as you say, still lingers. I think also the way we responded to it, the way we worked out little rituals, whether it was making bread or drinking cocktails, all of that seemed relevant to the way Marnie is living alone. You know, she has treats, she has routines, she has things to make her solitary life feel full. So there's an element of that experience in there. And for Michael, you know, Michael's marriage has broken up just before lockdown, and the close proximity, something else has happened to him, which you discover in the course of the book, but that close proximity for the marriage is devastating and sends them spinning apart, even though there's a lot to be said for the marriage. So it seemed to be everywhere, particularly in Marnie's self-consciousness, the way that when she talks to people, she worries whether she's saying the right thing, whether her face is doing the right thing. All of that, the self-consciousness of conversation, again, seemed relevant to this book. So the first draft of this novel was full of references to the pandemic, to lockdown, to COVID. And my editor, I think very sensibly, said, just pull back on that. Just take it out because, you know, you it isn't necessarily something that people want to read about or live in. I think there has been some really good art, good writing that's come out of our experience of the pandemic, but I didn't want it to be a pandemic novel. So it's definitely there, but it isn't at the forefront of the novel.
Does it be like a magnifier, really, almost like a catalyst for the kind of people that they were, but it's just made them more
exactly, so? Exactly, yes. For Marnie, Marnie has, she says, it's like she's come back from some time abroad and not told anyone. She's kind of withdrawn from her friends. She's become a little bit antisocial, a little bit frightened of human contact. And for Michael, it's been a part of a series of disasters in his life that has broken up what was a really wonderful, loving marriage, along with some other elements. It's definitely been a contributing factor. So, yes, it's definitely changed them. And yet, I think it's only mentioned once or twice in the course of the novel.
Yes. I just feel as though I mean, maybe it's because, like you said, the first draft had a lot of it, that it's very much kind of hanging in the background.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm very happy for it to be there. I mean, the resonance is definitely there, and it was definitely part of the genesis of the novel.
At what stage in your walks did you discover the joy of fresh socks?
Fresh socks. It's the key. I mean, I'm not quite... Michael thinks that he's going on a walk alone, so he only brings one shirt for the evening and two pairs of pants and two pairs of socks, which he washes in the sink every night. And this is fine. This is a fine way to live if you're by yourself. And of course, then when Marnie tags along, doesn't take her It doesn't take her long to notice the shirt coming up again and again. But yeah, the key to a day-long walk, I think, is just to sit on a rock at midday and change your socks. And you feel like a new person.
This is what you have done.
Oh, yeah.
Clearly.
Very much so, yeah.
Are you going to write the screenplay?
There's been some conversation about it. Yeah.
Would you like to write the screenplay?
I would like to. I would like to. I really love this book, and I love Michael and Marnie. I'm aware of the challenges of it. I mean,
it's very internal, isn't it, Anna?
It's very internal. You have the wonderful thing with a novel is you have conversation, and then you have analysis of conversation. You have the characters' intentions running parallel to what they actually say and do. And a novel is a wonderful form for thinking and feeling. And a screenplay is all about what people say and do, and that's it. That's the only thing you can put on the page. The internal stuff has to come from the performers, and that is also, you know, it's a challenge, but it's also great pleasure of adaptation. You know, you get these other people to provide that depth, and it's something I really love. But when you sit and write the screenplay, often it can feel very bare because you've thrown away most of the jokes. You know, most of the best lines in here are similes. There are no similes in the screenplay, or they're observations. It's not plausible to have characters walking around making witty observations all the time. You just can't do it. Or they're memories. Memory is a really hard thing to put on the screen. So that's why it's under consideration.
It sounds as though the novel is the natural place for this story, and this would never have emerged as a screenplay first up.
No, I don't think so. No, but that's often the case. You know, I wouldn't have written One Day as a Screenplay or Us as a Screenplay. They will have things in them which are absolutely novelistic and fit that form. So I never write a kind of screenplay in disguise, but at the same time, I do like writing dialogue. I like the novels to have a story and a structure. I like them to feel satisfying. I like set pieces, all of these things which do overlap with screenwriting. So it does come up. But at the same time, I like to make the most of the special tools you have when you write fiction.
I thought it might be possible to do an interview with you, David, without mentioning One Day, but it kind of isn't. But, you know, if you're talking to Paul Simon, you don't talk about Sounds of Silence because he's done that. You know, and then towards the end of his performing career, he embraced it and he realized it's what people wanted to hear, you know, and all that. So this is like Sounds of Silence. But, and again, you have revisited the song.
Yes.
How far I can take this analogy, but anyway, Paul Simon revisited Sounds of Silence, did it a number of different ways. You had an opportunity to, we all saw the phenomenal success of the Netflix version of One Day. What did you, how involved were you? I know you're executive producer.
Yeah.
In sort of changing anything, because you can, obviously it gave you an opportunity to go back to a story which you'd written quite a long time ago and change and think, well, maybe that, I could have done that differently back in the day.
Yeah.
Did it give you a chance to tweak?
Yeah, very much so. Though I, you know, I have to give full credit to Nicole Taylor and the writers she worked with. I did give notes on the scripts, but the governing idea for this project was that I didn't have any particular privileges because I wrote the novel. So I gave notes and
called. Oh, I'm sorry. You do. A note from David Nichols is not the same as a note from Brian Johnson in accounts.
It's true. They were absolutely ignored, and quite right too. And similarly, you know, I wrote one episode and I got notes on that. So it was very democratic, very happy. I love what Nicole did. I approved pretty much of all the changes. You know, the best adaptations are both a mixture of fidelity to the text plus original input, and they correspond to the time in which they're made as well, and that's as it should be. So I was really, really pleased to see the changes of emphasis that came from the scriptwriters, from the actors, from the directors, from everyone, and it was a really happy experience. I mean, exec producer sounds like one of those kind of cigar-chomping kind of cosmetic roles, and I was very involved at every stage in the edit and the music and the casting in the scripts, and it was incredibly fulfilling and happy, and I loved working with those people. They did an amazing job, and you can quite often it's a sort of adversarial relationship, isn't it? How dare you cut that scene, how dare you change that line? But I tried to go into it in an open-minded generous way and to let the changes happen. And I'm glad I did.
When you've had all that experience in writing screenplays, does it affect the writing of the novel? So the fact that you're obviously incredibly proud of this book. It is a fantastic book. Laugh out loud, funny. It's obviously going to be a huge hit, or is it already is a huge hit. But is there a part of you that's thinking that would, I wonder, I could cast, he looks a bit like Michael, maybe Marnie, and visualizing the way it would be if it does end up on a small or large screen.
I try not to too much. I mean, I do sometimes think of performers and it's never a single performer all the way through. But if you have a performer in mind, it can give you a little entrance into thinking about the rhythm of speech or tone of voice or physicality or attitude. And it's not, as I say, a single actor in my mind or a single personality or a single face. It changes scene to scene, but it does help. And I think also there's a way of writing dialogue. If you're very, very, very precise and careful with ellipses and dashes and where you put the descriptions and how it looks on the page, you can really give a sense of performance in prose. And that's something that I do definitely have in mind. And I'm extremely precise and careful, so that even looking at it on the page, you can tell whether it's a kind of rat-a-tat page of banter or a more thoughtful, contemplative passage. So that does definitely sneak in. Yeah, it's not so much screenwriting. It's an awareness of facial expression, rhythm, physicality that I try to put on the page, yeah.
Before we're done, I just want to mention Joyce Grenfell.
Yeah,
because she hasn't been mentioned ever on this podcast before. But you reminded me of the very first time that we meet Michael, the geography teacher.
Yes.
It's basically just it's just a monologue from him talking to his pupils.
Yeah. Yes.
And my parents had a recording of Joyce Grenfell doing George, don't do that.
Exactly.
All that. And that's, I thought, this is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was thinking of that. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Do you think
that's... I did think of that.
Do you know? So
yeah, I do know. Okay, yeah. Right. No, it's superb. Yeah.
It's a... maybe for people of a certain age, they'll get that. But it's very much, but funny, and just, we didn't need to know what anyone else was saying. We're just following it from the geography teacher's point of view on the field trip, thinking this is just enormously enjoyable.
Yes, I definitely had the Joyce Grenfell in my mind. But now it's the iPhone, isn't it? It's put your phone down. That's the recurring phrase in that speech. But it was definitely written as a monologue that could be performed straight off the page, yeah.
The new book from David Nichols is called You Are Here. You better read it before everyone else does, or, otherwise you'll have nowhere to join in most conversations over the next few months or for few years. David, pleasure as ever. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.